200. Visit NairaBets.com for details. The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is running like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. I was trying to buy 30 seconds for the Keurig. We've literally become like a coffee bar here. While I was away, when we were down in Florida, I stayed at my cousin's, my cousin Debbie's, and she had the Nescafe machine, you know, the Nesca, what is it? What is it called? Nesca? Oh, for goodness sakes. What do they call it? You know, George Clooney came to the house, actually, and set it up. Nespresso. Thank you, Casey. Nespresso. My cousin Debbie had it. And so now, Tina has now set up this coffee station. It's unbelievable. There's the bun. There's the major bun pot. You know, for the pot of coffee, usually two pots in the morning, she and I. There's the Keurig. So if I want an individual cup, now there's the Nespresso. And so she's set this thing up, and I'm gonna put up an umbrella. I could start making some madeleines, maybe, and croissant here for coffee shop. It's ridiculous. But I gotta say, I'm not an espresso. That's the last thing I need. All of you listening know the last thing I need is to be, you know, gurgling down espressos. Not gonna do me any favors. But it's kind of fun. It's all right. It makes like this foamy thing on top. It's pretty. It's all right. So I was trying to fire up the Keurig for a quick cup of coffee for the second half. I got to tell you, I mean, these last few months, I mean, we've been, I found myself getting to noon and like, you know, boom, folding like a cheap suit. Tom Law is expecting a call, but let me get to Chris Mears because I'm about half hour late getting to Chris. So we can do, let's do that first, all right? And then we'll get to Law and Franklin and Merrow and Eng. All right? Yeah. I hope I didn't blow this with Chris and that he's got something. I mean, they are getting ready to open the racetrack. So the and of course, whenever I need to go find something, it's never where I look. That's the great challenge of this desk. I got to tell you, there we go. Boom. All right. Bear with me. I also should mention, I think I want to look this up because I meant to reach out to Callie Francois because they're back at Pimlico today. And they've got a bunch of the carryovers, right? You've got, I'm not that interested in the jackpot thing, but there is the, I think there's the Super High Five, I think, today. Let me check on that. All right. But first, let's get Chris in here and talk about how he's going to manage the season. And we're certainly rooting for him, and we'll give him any help we can at Canterbury. You know, they've got the tremendous live gate that they've cultivated over the years, and so that part, I mean, in terms of attendance, Chris Murs, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to talk to you and getting excited about the season at Canterbury, even though you've got to acknowledge, you know, it's going to be challenging.
Yeah, we have a bit of a challenging battle here, but the racing office here put on a great card to start the weekend, and we got a lot of forward momentum. Javier Barajas, our dirt track supervisor, has got a nice track out there, and our turf guy, Kevin Cole's got the turf ready to roll. So we're full steam ahead here.
Well, talk about the expectations, and let's get, you know, all the I's crossed and T's dotted, so to speak. Calendar and what are we looking forward to?
We have a Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday schedule to start with us going to adding Thursdays on July 13th to August 15th. When our horse population gets a little higher, we'll go to 4 days a week. Our post time on Wednesdays is 5:07. Saturday is 5:07, and Sunday is going to be 1:07. When Thursdays come around, we'll have a 5:07 post. On Wednesdays, we're going to take advantage of our turf course here and offer a $1 all turf pick three every Wednesday. Take advantage of that. It's a $1 minimum with a 14% takeout.
Interesting.
And then all on our big days, June 21st, July 15th, August 12th, and September 9th, we're going to be offering all turf pick fives. It's a 50-cent minimum with a 10% takeout. And our early post-time pick four is a 10% takeout, and all our pick fives this year is a 10% takeout. So something for bettors to fire at.
Well, and that, of course, was a big innovation. And the Sampson family willing to try a reduced takeout experiment several years ago that it was hard to quantify, but it absolutely... In its own way, it worked. It sent an important message, and in terms of offering a product and a live atmosphere in Shakopee, that part you've got everything. You know, everything's been done the right way for a number of years, and it's one of the reasons that players should be, you know, looking at the cards and trying to contribute and support. You know, we talk about Hawthorne, you know, with what they're doing with the reduced whips takeout numbers. These tracks that are doing the right thing need to be supported by players.
Well, 100%, Steve. And the one thing about Canterbury as well, that this is one of the very few places in the industry where the mentality isn't, well, we've been doing it the same way for 100 years.
Right.
They're looking at ways to be innovative and move the needle forward. And it's been you know, for my 4 months that I've been here, I've been really happy with everything the way it's gone, and we're pushing forward and coming up with new ideas for not only this year, but for 2024 as well.
Well, I'm going to put up the links to some of the, you know, some of the easy reference material, including the season's schedule with all the highlights. And there's, you know, there's a lot of activities that are going on, using the racing as the centerpiece, but food and drink and music and dogs, and you got all kinds. You got a series. It's almost like it's a dog show series, right? You got the Bassetts, and you've got the bulldogs that are going to be out there racing. You got all kinds of fun things planned.
Yeah, no, it's great, and the marketing team here has put together a lot of great campaigns here to bring people here. We're really excited, and we have a great broadcast team with Paul Allen at the mic upstairs, with Kevin Gorg and Angela Herman. So we got a really solid team, and everybody's really excited to get the meet going on Saturday.
I'm also looking Wednesday specials, $5 admission, $5 beers, Thursday night special, Saturday date night, and all kinds of things. Family days on Sunday. It's one of the reasons that you guys average 7,500 through the turnstiles on days. Yeah.
No, it's great. Be my first time really experiencing it, so I'm looking forward to it. And I can tell you, you know, the people of Shakopee here are excited to get the meet going. We have a couple of concerts going on that two of them have already sold out. So the energy's here. It's time to get going.
In fact, I'm just looking at the Night Ranger in June, Marshall Tucker Band, which was the first concert I ever saw, June 23rd. Killer Queen, July 21st. Smash Mouth and Spin Doctors for a tremendous 90s night. And Randy Houser in September. So nice music series. Talk about the Minnesota Bred program. You've also got the Minnesota Bred, the Minnesota Ownership Initiative that is very active. It's obviously a fairly compact season, given the calendar and the weather and everything else, May to September. But there's a lot of promotion and the ownership initiative. Every time I see them do anything, Chris, I always try to amplify it a little bit, because it's one of the few places where I see an active attempt to bring people into the game as owners.
Now, what they've done here is really fantastic. They put a group together a few years ago that their sole mission was to bring new ownership here and get them accustomed to what goes on here in Minnesota and with the breeding and the racing and what goes on in Shakopee. So, we're always looking for new ways to bring owners into the groups, and the ideas that they've come up with here have been spurred around to other racetracks too, to bring them in. So they're kind of copying what we've done for the last several years. But the breeding program here is fantastic. The incentives we have for Minnesota Breds just keeps them coming along. So we're continuing to put a strong breeding program together and incentives here.
Obviously, with the Mystic Lake tie-in not available, certain things have changed when it comes to the stakes program. Now the Canterbury Derby. Talk about the stakes schedule too, Chris.
The stakes schedule really didn't take that much of a hit as far as eliminating races. We did have to lower the purses a little bit, but overall the stakes schedule is the same. I'm really happy to report that we have a lot of eyes on our June 21st Northern Stars Turf Festival Day. We're getting a lot of action already for that. We have that day circled, and we're looking ready to roll.
When do nominations close for the festival?
Nominations close. Tell you in one second. Got to get it in front of me. Nominations close.
Give or take. Yeah, you got it 2 weeks from yesterday to get the noms in. It's all on the website. And speaking of stakes, the opening features, you got a pair, boys and the girls. You got the 10,000 Lakes and the Lady Slipper. Lady Slipper, interesting. Lady Slipper drew much better for whatever reason. You got an even money favorite in that in the boys race.
Yeah, we got a couple good horses in the boys race. I was really happy with the way the Lady Slipper turned out. 10 horses, you know, the filly and mare divisions everywhere have taken a big hit, as you know, in field size. So we were really pleasantly surprised to see this, and it's our feature of the day, you know, with a really good horse in there. But you know, the Mac, the horse next to Charlie's Penny there, Ready to Run Away, looks like she has a good shot in there too. So she might be in there for an upset role.
Well, Mac Robertson, always a good friend to the racing office. Mac sending three in.
Yeah, no, Mac's been great with us, along with the rest of the trainers here, really supporting us really early on. And, you know, they wanted to see this program succeed here and keep it building up. So we appreciate everything that these guys do.
Chris, I mean, some of these people are going to be, a lot of them, I imagine, are, you know, your first time dealing with them. Let's take a look in terms of the training community and what we expect. Let's do a little of that, as well as the jockey colony. We talk about Mac, and you know, he's a perennial leader there with Joel Berndt, right? Tim Padilla.
We got a really good set of trainers here with Diodoro as well and Sean Williams. As you know, as far as the jockey colony goes, it's going to be led by Harry Hernandez this year, who has dominated down at Turf Paradise, and he's got a great supporting cast of characters. Alonzo Quinones, you know, he's been a great journeyman rider for a very long time. So we got a good, nice set of, we got a really young jockey colony here, which is going to be really exciting to watch. Guys that are really hungry and that are going to give their all throughout the meet.
You know, I pulled up last year, and I didn't remember this, but Joel Berndt, despite 100 less starters, he was able to tie Mac for the trainer title, 61 wins apiece.
It was incredible. He just got on a streak, and then Mac couldn't really keep him off of him.
Interesting. You know, you got a lot of guys that moved over from Fawner. I see a lot of Fawner Park names.
We got a lot of Fawner Park, Turf Paradise. We got a few people coming from Tampa, people coming in from Oaklawn, and we're looking to see if we can get some help from Hawthorne this year with them not running on Saturday. So we got a lot to choose from, which is good, and we got a nearly full backside, so we got a lot to work with.
Outstanding. Well, getting kicked off this weekend. Canterbury Park, and Chris, I appreciate it. We'll check in as the meet goes on, and we'll do some handicapping. We'll feature some of the big highlight days, and pass along anything you need me to communicate. Feel free.
All right, I appreciate your time, Steve, and thank you for having me on.
Not at all, Chris Murs, everybody, one of the top young racing execs out there, and. Basically having to replace another top young exec in Andrew Offerman, who had a terrific run. And, of course, Andrew now in New York. But bringing in a Chris Murs, who came up under Hammer, a very capable replacement for sure. Let's keep this in order, and I guess Tom's been listening. Tom Law is—he's ready. He's obviously. I can tell you're listening. In fact, I hear the show in the background. All right, turn down your radio, as they say in call-in show.
I did. I turned it down.
All right.
I was listening to your interview with Satish. He's one of my favorites. You know, spent some time with him back in those days when he was flying high and really rolling. And he's the kind of guy, you know, a journalist has to love. But he's my kind of person in general, just because he speaks his mind with no BS. And I was a little worried that you'd have to use the drop button there on him a few times.
Are you kidding? Never.
Satellite radio.
Never. Yeah. Never. Listen, there's people that have a drinking game. You know, the Satish F-bomb drinking game. There's there's the over under. There was action in Vegas. He was pretty good.
Oh, he's the man. Yeah, he's great. You know, and I just listening to him talk, it brought back a lot of cool memories. You know, obviously with him with Curlin and you know having horses like that and being involved with that. I probably have mentioned it on this show before. Even went and did a story with him out at his farm off of Old Frankfort Pike there in Kentucky one day and spent the morning with him. And it was fun. It was interesting for sure. But you know, he's always good with his time and accessible and you know upfront and you know was a real asset for the game for sure.
Well, he was more subdued than I expected. I think in part as I mentioned near the end there, I sent him the link that has the sale results. And for those of you, actually, I'm gonna mention this because for those that. If you ever want to do any research on sales, Blood Horse in this case, and I'm sure it's elsewhere, but I just go to Blood Horse because I know where it is, and I got a link in my bookmarks. I wanted to look up the Keeneland July 98 yearling sale, and it's right there. And you basically, not only do you get the results, but they tell you the names, you know, people, mm-hmm, you know, people mm-hmm. were like, oh, look, people, someone should look up those pips. And there's no real looking up required. You can see what those yearlings, who they ended up being. Mm-hmm. There's an app for that. So, Blood Horse's yeah. sales department.
That's great information. I mean, that's useful. It's funny. My accountant here in upstate New York he's involved in harness racing, but he's also a Reds fan like me. So we kind of commiserate throughout the year about various things. And he actually sent me a note yesterday inquiring about just that very subject, wanting to know where he could find just information on past Saratoga sales and specifically the names of the horses that were sold in recent years. So obviously probably I think his interest was piqued by National Treasure, I'm sure, being sold at Saratoga, and I'm sure he was there and probably remembering that. But very interesting for sure.
Yeah, there's I'll put a link up after the show. Where were you in 98 at this time? Were you at Thoroughbred Times?
At this very time, no, I wasn't there yet. Actually, in 98, I was still at the Saratogian. Actually, they sent me to go cover the Kentucky Derby. I remember them saying, hey, do you want to go down and cover the Kentucky Derby? And I'm like, of course. So they sent me down to cover the Derby. I actually ran into some guys that I knew from Thoroughbred Times who I had met in the press box at Saratoga, John Sparkman, Mark Simon specifically. They would come for the round table for the yearling sale, and they just got seated next to me up there in the press box while I was kind of doing my work. And I got to know them those couple summers. I saw them there at the Derby. And then when I got home from the Derby, probably about a week later, and then I was immersed in back in the world of covering high school, you know, sectional and state championship type stuff, which happened at the end of the year. I got a call from Thoroughbred Times, and they were like, we just happened to have somebody left. One of our staff writers left. Would you be interested in maybe applying for the job? And they had seen me at the Derby, and that kind of made them think that they put my name in their minds. So I was like, sure, of course. They're like, well, you want to get together and meet at the Preakness? We can kind of do an interview right there. And because I had to cover all that high school crap, I was like, I'm not going to the Preakness. And they were like, oh, really? You know, like that's a lot closer to where you are. But I was like, yeah, I know. Da 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 da. So long story short, I didn't ever came to Preakness until 2005 is the first time I actually ever went. But anyway, so I said, I'm going to be at the Belmont. So I interviewed around that time at the Belmont with Mark and Tom Lamara, who's now, who went to the Bloodhorse shortly thereafter, and then got the job. So I didn't come on board until, you know, a little later after the after that Keeneland July sale. I did work there when the Keeneland July sale was going on, the 99 one, obviously, and I covered Fusechi Pegasus in the Derby that year in 2000. So yeah, my first official day, I think, at Thurber Times was in the early part of August in 98. So just missed Fupeg going through the ring, but obviously was there for his Derby win. And I'll never forget Neil Drysdale after the race. He used to bring the guys up to the press box to do the Q&A, to do the press conference. And him standing there, and, you know, I could tell he was a little uncomfortable. And he started off his press conference basically by saying, all right, one thing, I want to set one thing straight, you know, no touchy-feely questions. You know, I mean, I've interviewed hundreds of people. I've heard hundreds of press conferences, and I remember that line so vividly, you know, like, no touchy-feely questions, you know? Like,
oh, that is great.
He didn't want to answer anything about, like, what is it like to win the Derby? How emotional is it for you? He was not having any of that, so... very on brand for him, for sure. I thought it was cool, though. I mean,
that is, you know, fabulous.
One of my two favorite Derby press conference moments. The other one was when somebody asked Mike Pegram after Real Quiet had won the Derby that 98 year, how long of a trip is it from Henderson to Louisville, and his response was about six beers. You know? So some classic moments, you know, classic. I mean, just the characters we have in our sport are just unbelievable. So we need more of them, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Desperately, in my opinion. We have a lot of them, but they're not super colorful anymore. I don't think as colorful. I mean, they're out there, but, you know,
it's hard. It's one of the reasons that a guy like Shark Hanlon shows up, you know, at Far Hills, and you know, wins with Uick, wins the Grand National, and you know, then back home is bringing him. You know, there's videos of him bringing Uick into the pubs. And it's like, we can use a little of that. That's a valuable, you know, especially in light of the way some outlets are choosing to characterize the sport. It's we didn't talk to you actually beforehand.
Yeah.
I ended up having to put those Clancy's on.
I bailed on you on Friday.
Yeah, that won't be forgotten.
I didn't bail, but I just was. I don't even know what the hell happened. I just was late. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, for you, given that the elevator wasn't working, you may have scaled the outside of the building. Did you?
No,
you didn't climb the building?
I've never been an elevator guy in general, especially not that elevator. You know, I felt like I was always going to get stuck on that thing. I mean, I've taken it before. I'm not going to make it sound like I have never taken it. But that elevator is just so old and decrepit. And that whole place is just so, like, it freaks me out a little bit, just being inside it sometimes. But I've always been a, you know, escalator to escalator kind of guy. I take the last flight of steps. You know, and it gets you walking around a little bit. You end up on those big days a lot of times just sort of standing in one place for like a long time, as you know. Especially there at Pimlico, you just go from, hey, I covered this, you know, I covered these 30 yards or something. So it's good to kind of get up and down. I do the same thing at Belmont even, which is a bit of a heftier, tall order of steps, but,
wait a minute. Wait a minute. You will go from the ground floor at Belmont. You will use the stairs to the sixth.
Yeah, sometimes you're, not all the time.
There's something wrong with you. I mean,
I got to get ready for hiking season.
For those of you that that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Honestly,
and often in dress clothes, you know.
Jesus.
I'm not doing it in shorts and like running shoes, you know.
Wow.
I mean, I wish I was.
Wow,
but...
I mean, that's impressive.
I'm not saying I do it all the time. I don't want to make myself sound like I'm, an ultra marathoner or something like that. That I just do it all day. But I'm back there, you know, doing steps. I'm getting my thousand flights of stairs or something.
Something wrong with that. You're absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
What?
A little bit, yeah.
Well, Tom, what? Because I did not read, I did not read any recap from your end, but
yeah,
your reaction to Saturday.
Well, Joe and I actually for our This Is Horse Racing website, Joe and I kind of teamed up on the story. He let off and he wrote a lot about Johnny. And his ride, making the difference, which is kind of on brand for us to take maybe a little bit different approach than everyone else is going to take with a story like that. Obviously, the story was Baffert winning the race, you know, after having the horse break down and die earlier on the card, and kind of his, you know, however it's being sold as a redemptive win, or he's back at the Triple Crown or something. So we definitely uncovered a lot of that and wrote a little bit about that. But Joe kind of focused mostly on the Johnny angle. But I was, you know, it's ironically, or I don't know about ironically, but I watched it. I was happened to be right there in the paddock, right next to Baffert when Having a Meltdown broke down, and then. I was down in that little saddling paddock area watching on TV with him for the Preakness too. So, very interesting to kind of be there for that and to sort of see it all unfold and, you know, to see the real emotion of the people that were with him and him himself. I don't think it's manufactured, by any means. It's very real. You can see the emotion, you know, it's, wife was in tears, and I know that it meant a lot to him too, obviously. But you know, as my colleague, you know, I stood next to my colleague and Tim Layton, he and I were standing right there, and he just kind of looks at me and afterwards is like, well, you know, this one's complicated. I thought to myself, yeah, you know, I mean, very much so, you know, a lot of ground to cover in covering a race. Whereas normally kind of just covering a race is, you know, who won and how they won and going from point A to point B. But, as we know, as we've watched unfold in the last, you know, several years, this is far from an easy story, and it is very complex, but, you know, at the end of the day, it was a horse race, and there was obviously tactics involved, and a very skilled tactician in John Velasquez, who's, you know, really the best in the business at it, and a horse that you know, was a top price yearling. You're talking about top price yearlings earlier, you know, not in the seven figure range, but $500,000 is a lot of money for a horse sold right here in Saratoga. Bred by a really good breeder, guy that, you know, does a great job in his breeding program, and sold here in Saratoga. Obviously, those guys means a lot to them. It's Fazy Tipton's team, so that's all part of the story too. So there's a lot of layers. You know, good for riders. You know, glad I have an outlet like Mid Atlantic Thoroughbred to write about it. You know, where we have the space and have a little bit of time to you know, let it simmer for a little while and think about the story. And, you know, Joe and I were talking about it yesterday and just all the different angles we could probably take. And we settled on a few, and I've kind of hinted about a little bit of it just now. So it'll be in the next edition of the of Mid-Atlantic. So hopefully hopefully people get to see that and read how we set the stage.
Well, it it certainly was provocative immediately. I sense that to some degree, as much as a flashpoint as it was Saturday night into Sunday, it seems to have just as quickly died down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which you know, the media is going to report on things the way they want to report on it. And I say this with all respect to my colleagues and other publications, but and it is news to report on it that horses are suffering injuries and dying, and but this happens all the time, and I'm not saying it happens a lot, because it doesn't happen a lot anymore, because there's because of a lot of efforts of a lot of people that have done a great job in helping to reduce some of these injuries. But you know, for outlets, both mainstream and in the racing press, to just sort of like really just continue to harp on it and to report on it all the time when they don't report on it on a day like today or another day, it's a little disingenuous, I think. You know, I guess it gets headlines and it gets people talking, but I don't think they're talking unless they actually see it. And I'm not saying to ignore it, but, you know.
Well, I've got a response
to
that. Well,
yeah.
Sure it is. It's complicated because you can't actively promote successful safety milestones.
Yeah.
First of all, it's something that tempts fate. Because spates of injuries are fickle and you know, we've got extraneous conditions, weather conditions, and you know, the ambient conditions that influence you know, the racing surface. So you know, when we get clusters of injuries and fatalities, they're random. When you try to draw attention to this area, you're just, you know, you're on a slippery slope. All we can do is when the topic is raised as part of the overall presentation of the direction of the sport, is to note the tremendous progress that's been made in a short period of time, that when this topic became more acute in the consciousness, the industry redoubled efforts, and with every opportunity basically evaluated approaches and habits and practices and have adjusted, and that's all you can do. And I don't want to be always defensive, but it's hard to be offensive on this particular topic.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. I'm always leery whenever I see those press releases from tracks, and they're happy about it, that they had no fatal injuries or something, and they just sort of promote that. All you're doing is setting yourself up for what happens next year when you have one. Then you're like, well, you didn't have a perfect year this year. You know, I mean,
it's
that goes
not
to your point. I completely agree with you. Yeah. So, you know, I think racing sometimes needs to take a little bit more ownership of what we actually are. I know it's kind of a controversial topic. A lot of people aren't really talking about, but, and again, I've said this on here before. we're talking about 30 people standing outside the track that are crying about horse racing, and you got 30,000 people inside that are going on a normal Saturday at Saratoga, and we get big stories about animal rights protests, or you have these radical animal rights groups that put out statements and this, that, and the other thing, and they got, they have 1,000 members versus, the thoroughbred industry has tens of thousands of people that both work in it and are considered, active fans. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm not saying it's not a big deal when horses suffer injuries or we're having these problems, but does it matter that much to a lot of people? I don't know. Walking around Pimlico after all that crap happened on Saturday, show goes on. Everybody's not really paying attention, and because they're in the setting, I guess. But and maybe it's not because they don't care, but they're just there and they're just kind of enjoying the day. I mean, like anything, unfortunately, in our world, people turn the page awfully quickly on very tragic things. But I don't know. We're going around and around. But, I think our industry has a lot of other real serious issues and problems that aren't necessarily always addressed. And we end up just talking about this kind of stuff.
Well, it's part when it's a big topic and when it presents itself, you've got no choice
to
address I don't think industry participants are being callous when they press forward. In the same way that people that work around animals on the farm and raise animals and you live close enough in Saratoga. I mean, I'm in Washington County, which is the second most agricultural county in the state. People are just that much more acclimated they wouldn't even identify them as tragedies. They would identify them as incidents, and they're sad. And you appreciate when you have working animals in your life and in your in your business practice, you appreciate their sacrifice and their partnership. And you press on I said this the other day on ESPN Louisville. I'm astounded that we're talking about less than 400 horses on an annual basis, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of careers and jobs. Livelihoods. I'm not going to say it's a small price to pay for the sustaining of livelihoods, but it's a small price to pay for the sustaining of the livelihoods that are involved. And I mean, compared to the wholesale commercial slaughter of other sentient beings, we're a eyedrop in the ocean.
Oh, without a doubt. And you look at all of our attackers and how some of our groups in our industry have sort of bent over backwards to either give them a voice or give them a seat at the table. It's just beyond ridiculous.
Correct.
I mean, beyond. It's unbelievable. And then those groups really should take a real hard look at themselves, whether how serious about the sport and the industry they are.
You're not the first person to bring that up.
I agree. I'm speechless about that sometimes.
There you go.
Boggles my mind.
Well, I've got quite a bit I got to get in yet, Tom.
Yeah.
So let
and you
me...
got to get your Keurig going. I mean, you've got great taste, Steve. You're one of the people I really respect. That like Steve Vick has great taste. If I need to know where to get a donut, to get a cake, to get an ice cream, to get a dinner, a sandwich, I'm going to ask you. Well, any city in America, but not Keurig. Don't drink Keurig coffee. It tastes like a plastic. What piece of plastic.
What are you talking about? The coffee is what's in the little cup that counts.
Like the pod? Yeah, but the pod, when you put that pod goes in there and that heat heats up that plastic, that coffee tastes like plastic.
I don't have that problem. I don't know what exactly you're I can tell you that a lot of the, first of all, let's start with Pete's.
I didn't mean to attack your coffee.
This is an outlandish affront, to be honest. If you take, let's say, Pete's, for instance, Pete's coffee.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All good stuff. Yeah.
All right.
Good.
Well,
workable daily coffee. Yeah.
There's a little filter inside the cup. You realize that?
Filter inside what, the little pod?
Yes.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
Next case.
I do have a Keurig that has a single use.
Yeah,
pod.
I've got
I
that.
I actually have one that is it's a reusable one. So you just put your coffee into that
right.
little pod.
Of course.
And then I dump the used grains into my compost, which turns into my compost, which goes into my garden.
So you're
yeah, it's garden week here in Saratoga for all those interested. Yeah, gonna get the garden in.
Wow.
We'll talk about that at another date. That's become famous. A lot of people are asking me in Pimlico, have I planted my garden yet? So
unbelievable.
Stay tuned for updates this summer.
Well, now not only do we call you Kayak Tom, now you're now you're organic compost, Tom.
You got it. Another layer. There's another layer to the onion.
You
peeled another layer.
You're a big tall onion. All right. You're a regular. You're a regular shallot, is what you are.
You know it, buddy.
Oh my God, Tom Law, everyone, Saratoga TL on your Twitter machine and. Tom, I'm glad we were able to connect.
Yeah.
Glad you didn't show up at 12:01.
Yeah, me too. Thanks. I'm back on my normal game. So
that a
I'll
boy.
Be here from now. Whenever you need me.
Thank
me
you, Tom Law, folks. Too fun. He's all right. Let me I've just gotten 7 messages here right away. Let's get to Jeff Franklin. We got to do our thing, our Thurgraph conversation, and you still have time. Yeah, you kind of do actually. Thurgraph.com, and click on the little green box. Click here. Put in the email address, and almost instantaneously. The file will come to you with today's conversation races, the 6th and the 7th, Saturday, at the Great Race Place. And big weekend, obviously, at Santa Anita, highlighted by Monday. I came inches, if it wasn't for the new baby, baby Marley, if it wasn't for Marley, we would have gone out to California, particularly for the Monday card, which is going to be the Hollywood Gold Cup, the Shoemaker, and the Gamely, 3 grade ones at Santa Anita on Monday. We'll talk to Hammer tomorrow. And actually, wait a minute. They're not going to have drawn those races, so we may not be able to talk those until Monday, actually. We may be coming to you from Rochester Monday, holiday Monday. We may stay out there for like 3 days. Jeff Franklin, though, is standing by. I was giving everybody time, Jeff, for them to maybe get the email if they hadn't yet.
Good idea. Thanks, Steve.
Hold on.
Thanks
there
for...
we go. Sorry.
thanks for spending time regarding Canterbury, which was one of my stops on the way in the old days as a jocks agent. And I have to tell you, one thing that's not well appreciated about the community there is how much they adore horse racing. So I went up there the second year at Canterbury's meet. I had Kenny Black. Johnny D had Sandy Hawley. After 17 days of racing, we won 81 races. it was crazy. And one night after the races, I took Kenny to the Shakopee house, you know, like kind of sort of across the street from the track for dinner. And as we walked across the restaurant, it's a very, very large restaurant, the fans there stood up and gave him a standing ovation. I mean, where do you get that kind of, I mean, this is like Michael Jordan-esque, you know? These people were so appreciative of what racing had brought into their lives. It was just wonderful.
That was for Johnny D.
It wasn't for Johnny D. I took Kenny there. Johnny D, he was probably in the bar doing something else.
I'm not so sure. I'm going to get Johnny to corroborate this story.
Go for it. Go for it. Tell him I said hi. I haven't spoken to him in a couple of months now.
Well, you know, I tell you what, that must have been some summer because you had Davidowitz around too for the Star Trib, right?
Yes, sir. Yep, we did. In fact, guess who fourth leading rider was at that meet? Well, I'll cut to the chase.
Mike Smith.
Yeah,
of course, Mike Smith. That shouldn't be news. A lot of people know that that's where he broke. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and who did we know at the time that we were competing against greatness? And you know, Mike Smith became great. Mike Smith. You know, wow. And here's another thing about Canterbury that I just loved. I've told this story to a lot of folks. At the end of the meet, when we left, I realized I couldn't tell you, because we were speaking earlier about horse health, et cetera, I never saw the horse ambulance.
Hmm.
Not one time.
That's amazing.
Those days, Steve, they were racing $2,500 and $4,000 claimers at some of the races. They had some good stakes as well, but never saw it. Never saw a horse fanned off. Never saw a horse get injured the entire meet.
Amazing.
Anyway, I digress. Thank you for letting me say that.
Well, and I came, you know, it's funny because I came very close to, for the selection of the, for the selection of races, I came very close to using that lady slipper, the nightcap Saturday at Canterbury. But it kind of felt like the two favorites seemed, I mean, I was looking at that point, I hadn't looked at sheets. I was only looking at PPs. I ended up tabbing Santa Anita, and I suppose we should actually hit a quick recap from last week, right?
Sure. Actually, I think we owe folks a recap from the last 2 weeks, because the previous weekend we did the Man-O-War. We did the Man-O-War and the Peter Pan, and then last week we did the Sprint and the 3-0 Phillies and the Turf. So, I don't know about you, but I thought both weeks had a lot of very interesting thoroughgraph lessons. One, to be sure, I didn't play either race on the Man-O-War day for obvious reasons. Warren Point was bet off the board. Oh, by the way, did you guys discuss the starting gate incident that happened with him?
No.
You know, he went into the gate with a hood and a blanket.
Oh, okay.
And apparently... Yeah, apparently there was confusion coming out whether or not the jock or the assistant or whether the starter was supposed to remove it. And I wasn't even aware of this, but some of my friends in the jocks room here in Southern California were talking about it, because evidently in Europe they have one protocol. Here we have another. And so apparently in Europe the jock actually flicks off the hood or any of the other, you know, loading blankets, et cetera. Here, it's the starter. So I don't know if Frankie got confused or, you know, if maybe just one of those things happened, but, you know, the horse came out sideways. And it really didn't matter for our purposes because he was bet up, you know, what was he, 2-5? It wasn't a betting race. But it was an interesting race nonetheless. And you may recall we talked about the Charlie Whittingham story about requiring rest between two races. And, you know, Red Knight won the race off of only 20 days rest, which would seem to refute the Charlie Whittingham learning. But so many of your listeners emailed me and said, thank you, Charlie, for a new handicapping lesson. And one of them pointed out that of the five horses, we're talking an eight-horse field, five horses who had run in Keeneland in the previous race, four of them missed the board. So pretty interesting stuff, I thought, in that race. And then, you know, in the Peter Pan, we, you know, kudos to you and I, we nailed the exact precisely. But I mean, when Arcangelo got bet from 10 down to 5-2, it turned out to a non-betting race to me. I thought at 10-1, I was licking my chops, and then, oh, well, what are you going to do? So that was Manowar. And then, let's see, last weekend, well, of course, in the sprint, they scratched Al Loves Josie, made it a non-betting race. And then I went all after eight, and she had no excuse. She looked beautiful on the racetrack. Yeah, she cooked on the front end, went far too fast. I boxed her with the winner, unfortunately, but she just didn't fire. So nothing's perfect, I guess.
All right.
How about you? Any other insights as to that?
Well, I mean, there were some interesting, actually, not that they were races that we were able to feature, but there were some spots, and I've got to, we have to figure out a way to put them on the website and for me to feature them too, you know, kind of in red board room fashion a little bit. I mean, some of them are things I discussed in advance, including last week the race in Indianapolis, the stakes race with Gigante. But you know, Gigante, for instance, you know, I'd like for us to offer up some snapshots to people so that they can see, you know, the kinds of horses. I mean, because not every race we discuss, you know, ends up being, you know, the idyllic example. I mean, they can offer, you know, plenty of hints, but there's, you know, there's on a daily basis at far-flung ovals, you know, there's spots like Gigante last week. He went off at an insane price in that stake at Indy. Coming back off of for a seasonal debut. I mean, this is one of my favorite, you know, that angle we talk about horses that have been away, and people think, you know, people look and they say, well, this horse isn't fast enough. Well, he might not have been fast enough as a 3-year-old, but now he's a 4-year-old. And so he's a different horse just by virtue of natural progression and natural development. And, you know, you can use the Thoregraph Index of horses to project that kind of improvement. I mean, if a stallion, if their progeny improved by 3 points on average from 2-3 or from 3-4, and you see a horse that was running eights last year and they're coming back 6 months later, they very well are going to likely be able to run around a five. And that's how you project a horse that's competitive at a price in a race where it's not going to be obvious to the general public. And that's Thoregraph's, you know, Thoregraph's in most invaluable aspect is being able to, you know, project what a horse is going to do in this spot for the various reasons, utilizing the various figures and stats that are offered on the sheets. So with that in mind, let's take a look at the 6th and the 7th Saturday at Santa Anita.
Well, and I couldn't have queued up a more perfect segue than what you just said, because the 6th race is all about the team at the sheets now for the race. You can very quickly get it down to about, well, a couple of horses that are just very, very fast and would figure to be the logical selections. Katona, who Doug O'Neill's horse just paired fours. And the question always is, are those two efforts, like, are those not one but two times where the guy's run a marathon and he's about to collapse? Or is this a horse that's rounding into his potential? And the TGIs may help to unlock that. Look at the, and I'll, for those folks that aren't looking at the sheets, just here are the average best numbers of his sire, of Clint's offspring. As a 2-year-old, 20. As a 3-year-old, 18. As a 4-year-old, 13. This horse is a 4-year-old. You can see massive development right here, right now. What we're seeing on the sheet is 7-8-7-4-4 going two turns. Wow, that's a very impressive pattern, and it's leading me. I mean, it's always a chance that there were two efforts in a row and that he'll regress. Okay, but the TGIs are giving strong indication this horse is actually rounding into his best form. There's another horse in the race who similarly fits the pattern. That's Showtime. Now, he's a lot slower. He just paired sevens for Richard Mandela off a layoff. But he's also equally intriguing for another reason. That is, during the layoff, he was gelded. So let's get this right. A horse has a layoff. He's gelded. He comes back, and he pairs two lifetime tops. What are his TGIs? 15.5, 12.5, 9.5. Massive development as he gets older for the infamous chips. So, we've cut right to the chase of the two horses I'm most interested in. I don't have the benefit of seeing the morning line, but that's how I see the sixth race, is focusing on those two. What about you, Steve?
You've absolutely hit on the pair up and you know what you might expect, especially in the hands of somebody like Mandela. I mean, the horse to beat, from a fig standpoint, who's got a very healthy, he's a 4-year-old, is Katona. For Doug O'Neill out the seven. I mean, he makes tremendous sense, even if he just pairs up. But he's most likely, I don't have, let's see if John White's line has been added to the sheets. John may be listening and might be able to even send along the odds. Let's see. I'm just pulling up the PPs. Are they got the,
and
they
got Steve, final? While you're doing that.
Yeah.
While you're doing that, I might want to point out another thing that I've always found useful with Thoragraph over the years, is it actually gives you a pictorial idea of how a horse rounds into form and when they bounce or regress, how long it takes them to recover. Because there's another interesting horse in the race called Phineas that Pete Miller trains.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting about him is that he gives about three examples of when he runs a new top, it takes him some months to recover. So he ran a 7.5 at Del Mar. It took him 4 months to get back to a 4. He ran a 4 event at Del Mar. It took him 4 months to get back to the 4. He's just run an 8, and he's coming back in like 7 weeks. So for my money, I'm going to say, yeah, it wouldn't shock me if he ran the 4 and won the race. But odds are he'd run another recovery race, and maybe his next start we're looking at him, which might be in the more like the 3 to 4 month period. And horses do repeat these patterns. They're organisms. They have, you know, systems. They recover, with different frequency than most people. So
that,
there you go.
And the Phineas example, because Phineas is almost as fast as Katona on figs.
Right.
That curling back up toward toward either a new top or a pair up, it's quite remarkable actually that he's done this twice. With the 11.75, the 11.5, that was on turf, and then a 10.75 back to the new top of 4.75, then a 9, an 8.5, and an 8 back to 4.75. It's very distinct. This horse's pattern, and you know he hasn't won in a long time, but this is a horse that has got to be at least acknowledged as, if not you know, maybe watch him. And you know, whenever it looks like he's to the public tailing off, you know, be prepared. You know, he's 6-1, 7-1, 7-1. You know, it's kind of interesting, actually, what you know, how this horse, he's a cowbred, so he moves back and forth between open company and cowbred competition. It's a kind of an interesting horse. At some point, I imagine they probably, I don't know if there's anywhere for this horse to go per se, but something tells me he ends up, you know, being dipped in for a tag to, you know, to break through to win next time. He's clearly healthy. I mean, he runs with regularity, but he is a horse whose good efforts have taken a chunk out of him. Well, I wanted to do the six so that we could maybe get some doubles going into the seventh, and the seventh is down the hill. It's one of my favorites. We've got a horse that might prove very tough in here, and Sammy Glick, for those of you that know, what makes Sammy run? Mark Glatt brings him back off that Siren Lure win, and he's already won a graded stake down the hill, and he's going to try to do it again. Sammy, what makes Sammy run?
Steve, I agree, and, you know, what a, boy, the type of racehorse we all want to own, right? He doesn't regress. He fires all the time, and from a sheet's perspective, he's rock steady. Some people might view the two that he just ran as a bounceable pattern. I just say this is just a rock solid racehorse with a tremendous base. When he regresses, it's a point or two. He could bounce to a three or something, or a four, and you know, still potentially win the race. Beyond that, I found the race interesting because they actually have a stakes race at San Anita on the turf without a D'Amato trainee, so, you know, some money to be spread to the other guys. But there were about two or three other horses in the race that you could make the case could move back to a three and mess with Sammy. And I would say I'm not very confident that will occur, but one interesting horse is on the outside, and that's Burning Turf. And, you know, he did run a three coming down the hill. And I think his last two efforts obscure the fact that he might be so for folks who aren't looking at this, he ran a three down the hill, which is a really fast number, last year. So Dan Blacker gives him, you know, several months off. He takes him up north and runs him on the synthetic at Golden Gate, something he obviously didn't like. He ran 14. It was a non-effort. Then he came back and ran a five, only a couple lengths slower than Sammy can run. And yet, I think the official Equibase chart said he was in a bit tight early. I thought he got slammed pretty well. So give him a fair trip, and what would he be looking like if he ran a three here? You'd be saying, wow, he ran right back to where he's at. So that three potential puts him as the other horse I'm interested in for race. I'll be fascinated what the line maker lays in that, because off the layoff, we're looking at an eighth-place finish and a fourth-place finish. So he could be the other horse I'd really want to time in with.
Nice.
But well, Sammy's rock solid, yeah.
Yeah, right, the horse to beat. And then, you know, for those pressing further, the triple bend follows this, and looks like it's okay. Forbidden Kingdom comes back. It's a nice sequence. It's a nice card Saturday, and it's going to be a nice weekend at Santa Anita. That Spirit of Makina for George Papa Padromo and Bruce Chandler looks like he'll be tough in the San Carlos. So it looks like a little pick three to put together Saturday at Santa Anita. Well, Jeff, I appreciate it. And for those that were just listening and didn't have the sheets in front of you, go to thoroughgraph.com, click on the click here, sign up, and you'll start to get the two races a week sent to you. And we're trying to teach you how to look at sheets, and send Jeff any questions that he might have, or me. You can ask us on Twitter as well, etc. So win using Thoroughgraph.
Thanks, Steve. Take care, all.
Jeff Franklin, folks, Crafty JF. Let me see if we can't scare up Seth And because this has gotten to be bad. I don't think he's happy. I'm not hearing back from Seth Merrow. I don't know what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to send out a search party. Oh, there he is. All right. All right.
You got me.
I'm sure you're mad at me, and I feel terrible.
No. when you brought the Thorograph analysts on, I thought, well, I'm going to miss another. So I was just in the shower, but I heard the phone ring. I thought, oh, okay. I was getting ready for TV. I was going to head out the door.
Well, you still can. You've only got to talk for 10 minutes.
Okay. I'll make it work.
Now, I last week, you obviously sensed what was going on. I mean, when we're up there at Pimlico and it just...
I know when there's boots on the ground, I'm likely to maybe not make it in.
Well, but then when you didn't reach out and you didn't, I was expecting, you know, Sunday morning at Waffle House.
The guys in the control room, I said, oh, Vic's going to think I'm stiffing him because I wasn't on this week. But I had Frank Vespi on because he talks Maryland with me all year long. So on their biggest day,
there you go.
Frank and from the racing biz. So we talked a little bit. I said, oh, okay, Vic's gonna misinterpret this.
Yeah, man, I thought he didn't. There was a problem though, because instead of boots on the ground, we were getting baby booties on the ground with the new baby. So we were
excellent.
Yeah,
excellent.
No
I'm
boots.
Sure Tina is thrilled.
Oh my God, like crazed. she's we're going to go back to Rochester, I think, tomorrow afternoon.
Fun. So. Nice. I'm envious.
Yeah.
It's kinda... You're living the life. Everybody's envious. Tom Law's talking about all the good eats you have, and you got the family, and, yeah, good for you and Tina.
Well, thank you. I've got you as a TV partner. Who could ask for more?
Just another check on the checklist of life.
Ticks all the boxes. Well, what was your Pimlico weekend?
I think the Triple Crown races to me are just very subjective because we're so plugged in going back to the 2-year-old season, and in a way we are on normal weekends because we plug in, you know, the 2-year-olds and, hey, is this going to be a horse for the Triple Crown? And then the early 3. And so you're just so plugged in that I think how your handicapping and betting goes on these big weekends kind of influences, you know, how enthusiastic you are. So Maze was lightly raced and I just couldn't pull the trigger. So, that affected how I felt about the Derby. And then, I used a little National Treasure in the mix, but I didn't know what to do with Blazing Seven. So I left him out. I played around with Perform, but I knew that was kind of feast or famine. I knew that could go either way. Either I'd be right and he was moving in the right direction, and that Tessio was just a signal of that, and they were right to have the confidence to put up the 150,000, or the buyer figures might have been right and he just wasn't fast enough. Now, all that said, the scenario didn't really play to his strength either. But, you know, the pace in the Tessio wasn't blazing fast either. But anyway, I used some Perform, had Mage in the mix. And personally, it was a little bit, as they say, frustrating. But being objective, going back to the Derby, I thought the first three finishers in there ran very well and worth watching going forward. And I thought it was in the Preakness, it was a fun stretch duel. I was a racing fan. It was just a ding-dong battle. But I think we come out of these first two races now thinking it may be one of those years with the 3-year-olds that we won't possibly define them until they meet up with the older horses in the fall. I mean, nobody's really stepping up, and there's still the summer races to go. They still could change. Belmont, Haskell, Jim Dandy, Travers, Pennsylvania Derby could still, you know, there's the opportunity there for somebody to add a little luster to their resume and kind of step forward, you know, maybe a year where they're all kind of just beating each other a little bit and things will define each other as we get, again, towards the end of the year and they
they face some others. So we'll see how that works out. But again, like Derby weekend, I thought it was a fun weekend at Pimlico. I thought on the three-year-old Philly side, I thought the top couple of fillies coming out of the Black-Eyed Susan are going to play nicely in that three-year-old Philly division. I personally had a nice little Capital OTB promotion. We had a bankroll down at the clubhouse racebook. And if people aren't familiar, I get a chunk of money and patrons come in and put their name in the hat and they select the team. And I play on behalf of the team and everybody splits up the winnings at the end of the day. And I have to say, I was not handicapping spectacularly on Preakness Day. My opinions just weren't that great. But I had one bet in the middle of the day. I played a pick four in the middle of the day. And when it got to the race with Shugsworth's Never Explained,
yeah,
I think it was the third leg in that pick four. And I hadn't that horse had just missed my pick four ticket. And the more I looked, the more I thought, I don't want to. This horse is going to be a $30 horse. I don't want to go down with the ship if this horse wins. So I played a pick three, the Shug horse, all. And so I wound up, and then the next race, Chatera wins at a big price. And so the 50-cent pick three paid $6.50, and everybody on the bankroll team walked away happy with a little chunk of money because I hit a couple other small things during the day. So it wound up to be kind of a fun day. But as I say, on the Preakness itself, I was hoping performed better.
Well, you know what? What you just said is a tremendously valuable little aside and sidebar, because you, especially on days like Triple Crown cards, and you know, you do go and you know, you make your committed plays, but then you're also watching the board. I mean, I Never Explained was my fourth horse, you know, in the pecking order too, and I thought that was a nice number on him. So that's a very clever maneuver, and you know, why not on that turf sprint hit the all button? You know, the race after too, that would have been Beer Can Man, right? That would have been the turf sprint, the Jim McKay.
Yeah.
So $6.50 for 50 cents. It's tremendous.
That was nuts. Yeah, it was great. I mean, with Chatera, that one, you know, they're coming down the stretch, and a long shot, I want to say something in maybe the 8-1 range took the lead, and we were kind of, okay, this is great. And then the horse came on the outside. Who's that? Oh, it's a bigger price. And then everybody started to kind of jump on board. So it was a fun day. Because, again, if you're playing for the team, I'm announcing the plays ahead of time. So they all knew we were looking for a big price, and the team was,
good job,
was quite happy. But it also looked like a sequence. When I looked and I saw the Shug horse at the price, I knew I wanted to do something with that. And I looked at the next two races, and I thought, you know, these are races that I think something a little kooky could happen. So it made it worth taking a little bit of a shot with the all button.
Nice work. We also had, and on that topic, since Chatera came up, and I'm sure I'll mention it with tomorrow with James, Scully, that was Scully's big score on the day, was Chatera.
Oh, nice.
Who he was nice. All over. And Callie gave us, when Callie and I went over the Friday card on Wednesday, she, I want to say it was the first time starter of Kerry Brion's, I think, at 7-1 that she liked, that Caroline Christina that paid like $16. She had everybody had a, you know, a spot here and there. It was that kind of a weekend. You know, for me, it was
Friday was doing okay. Saturday, like I say, I struggled a little bit, except for, again, the kind of wacky play in the middle of the card. Hit a couple small things, but we move on.
What do we, we got less than a minute. What'd you play today?
With Belmont, I'm normally the last few Thursdays, I've been doing a Twilight TV, but I'll go ahead early today, do a little Gulfstream and a little Delaware underway. But I got a couple ideas of Gulfstream just quickly. In the first race, I had it 1-8-3-2. But the more I look, I like Kozan as a win early sire. I may play some doubles because I like one in the second race. So first race at Gulfstream today. Again, I have a 1-8-3-2, but I'm going to play around with a 3, Cozy Red by Kozan. But the one I'm a little more enamored with is in the second race. This one I have is the top pick, 4-2-7-8, second race at Gulfstream. We've talked about it before. I really like Caraconte as a sire.
Yeah,
win early
you've been on top of that.
Yeah, and it has paid off a number of times. And hopefully, you know, we're looking at 8-1 on the morning line on number 4, April's Diamante. A couple of nice siblings. There's a sibling called Mr. Beams that won its debut, another sibling called My Man Flint that won in the second start of the career. So I think there's a little wind early, top and bottom. So I'll play around with the 4. I had the second race, 4-2-7-8. But number 4, April's Diamante at 8-1 on top in the second.
Love it. Good job. Seth Merrow,
right,
everybody.
Thanks.
Get in the car. Seth Merrow, folks, and he'll be on Capital OTB right now. We're going to send you out to the race day. Want to send us off with some Tina Turner. You've probably heard plenty of Proud Mary already. This is River Deep, Mountain High, which I love. She was a force that overcame plenty. A woman to admire. Tina Turner. Thanks to Chris Hyde, Chris Merz, Sadiq, Tom Watt, Jeff, and Seth. Talk to you tomorrow, everybody.